Well, now we have covered the first five chapters of Daniel, and we've come to the end of the Babylonian kingdom with the death of Belshazzar. Now, just a little bit of history and the like to get us caught up on these things. We have some history here that is quite old, written first back in the, in the 4th century B.C. and about the time that some of these events are going on that we've just been talking about. And so we have there Nebuchadnezzar, the last of the great kings, and then his son Nabopolassar, and then evil Merodach, and finally Belshazzar, and that is the end. Now, this history that I have here was written in the 4th century B.C. by Herodotus, and he was called the father of historians by a man with the name of Cicero, a great Roman statesman, and it seems that before his time, people had, in writing history or making odes and all that sort of thing, they made such an extravagant thing of it that there wasn't any profit in it at all. You couldn't believe it. And so Herodotus started writing history, but he was not writing it particularly to perpetuate history. He was writing it really as stories. And so when we get to reading his, why, we have to watch that. Now, I will read a little bit from Herodotus and give you some ideas. Times back in these places. Many kings, whose names I shall mention. Now, just a moment. Everything was going all right. In my discourses, the Assyrian affairs reigned formerly in Babylon, and beautified the city with temples and other public edifices, but none more than two women. Notice this. The first of these, named Semiramis, lived five generations before the other, and raised such banks to prevent the inundation of the river, which frequently overflowed all the plain of Babylon, as deserved admiration. But the other, whose name was Nicotris, having, after it obtained the kingdom, and being much more provident, not only left monuments of herself, which I shall describe, but when she saw the power of the Medes growing formidable and strong, and that they had taken the city of Ninus with diverse others, she made all imaginable provisions for defense of her territories. Now, I don't know just why that the author here is making these two women so prominent. Well, Semiramis, mentioned her first in five generations before Nicotris, was the wife of Nimrod, the first man to engage in warfare and hunt his fellow men, a founder of Babylon, and also of Nineveh. And so we come down here, and here is this one just mentioned here. Nicotris, well, she was the wife of Nebuchadnezzar. And this historian doesn't mention Nebuchadnezzar at all. So you see, there's two sides probably to the question. And by the way, some generations later, there's another one, the name of Nicotris, who did wonderful works in Egypt. But that isn't in our story. All right, and to that end, in the first place, she caused a channel to be opened above Babylon with as many various windings to receive the stream of the Euphrates, which before ran in a straight line, that this river was made to touch no less than three several times at one single town of Syria, called Argerica. And all those who now ascend from the sea by the way of Babylon are necessitated to pass thrice with that place in three several days. Much higher than Babylon, a little distance from the Euphrates, she caused a spacious lake to be made, 420 stades over on each side, and in depth till the workmen came to water. She bordered the edge of this lake quite round with stone, and all the earth they threw out was disposed of by her direction to augment the banks of the river, which by that means were of astonishing height and thickness. These two things she did, that the current, being broken by frequent inflections, the river might move on but slowly, and that the capaciousness of the lake might render the navigation of Babylon long and difficult. All this was done in that part of the country which lies next to the Medes, and is their shortest way to Babylon, to the end that they might have no opportunity of discovering her affairs by an easy communication with the Assyrians. Both these works she strengthened with a solid facing from the bottom, and erected another between the two divisions of the city. For considering that Babylon is divided by the river into two parts, that all persons who pass from one side to the other during the reign of former kings have been necessitated to make use of boats, which in my opinion is very troublesome, she provided the following remedy, and after having sunk the draining lake I mentioned before, left this also for a monument of her fame. She ordered stones to be cut of large dimensions. When they were ready, commanded a great compass of ground to be opened, and the current of the Euphrates to be turned into that lake, that place. By this means, when the water was drained out, the ancient channel became dry. She lined the banks of the river on both sides with a facing of burnt brick, below the little gates that lead to the water within the city, and cemented as the walls had been. Which having been done, she built a bridge about the midst of the city with the stones she had prepared, binding them together with plates of lead and iron. Upon these stones, planks of squared timber were laid by day, that the Babylonians might pass over from one side to the other, but were removed at night to prevent mutual robberies. But when the lake was filled with the water of the Euphrates and the bridge finished, she brought back the river to its ancient channel. This invention of the lake was much applauded, and thus a bridge was built for the use of the inhabitants. And I'll just interrupt you to say that the night that Belshazzar was killed, that the Medes had done the same thing. They had diverted the river into that lake and gone in by the riverbed, dry riverbed practically, and the gatekeepers along the river were drunk, and so they just easily entered into the city and were all over before Belshazzar knew about it. Now this same queen laid this snare for succeeding time. She prepared a sepulcher for herself over the most frequented gate of the city, exposed to open view with the following inscription: "If any one of my successors, kings of Babylon, should find himself in want of money, let him open this sepulcher and take as much as he shall think fit. But if he be not reduced to real want, he ought to forbear. Otherwise he shall have cause to repent." This monument continued untouched till the reign of Darius, who, judging it unreasonable that the gate should remain useless to the inhabitants, for no man would pass under a dead body, and in inviting treasure be rendered unserviceable, broke up the sepulcher, and instead of money, found hold of the body, and these words: "Hadst thou not been insatiably covetous and greedy of the most sordid gain, wouldst not have violated the sepulcher of the dead." And this is the account they give of Gatochris, queen of Babylon. Well, there's a little bit more to the story. Cyrus made war against Labynetus, the son of this queen. That's going on down a little bit. Who had his name and the kingdom of Assyria from his father. And when the great king leads his army in person, he has with him cattle and other provisions in abundance. The water he drinks is brought from the river Coapes, which runs by Susa, where the kings of Persia drink of no other. And this water, being first boiled and preserved in vessels of silver, is loaded on many wagons, drawn by mules, and carried after him whithersoever he goes. Cyrus, arriving at the river Gindes, in his march toward Babylon, endeavored to pass over with his army, but the river was not fordable. The Gindes rises in the hills of Nahenhi, and descends through Dardania, and falls into the Tigris, which, passing by the city of Opus, runs out into the Red Sea. In the meantime, one of those who were mounted on white horses, accounted sacred among the Persians, with an audacious petulancy, pushed into the river. But the current proved too strong, and threw him suddenly with his horse to the bottom. Cyrus, much offended with the river for this affront, threatened to render his stream so contemptible that women should pass over to either side without wetting their knees. After which menace, deferring his expedition against Babylon, he divided his army into two parts, and having marked out 180 channels by the lines on each side of the river, commanded his men to dig out the earth. His design was indeed executed by the great numbers he employed, but the whole summer was spent in the work. Thus Cyrus punished the river Gindes by draining the stream into 360 trenches, and in the beginning of next spring advanced with his army toward Babylon. Upon his approach, the Babylonians, who in expectation of his coming, had drawn their forces, gave him battle, and being defeated, fled back to the city. But having been long acquainted with the restless spirit of Cyrus and his custom of attacking all nations without distinction, they had laid up provisions for many years, and were under no apprehensions about a siege. On the other hand, Cyrus himself, finding much time consumed and his affairs not at all advanced, found in a great doubt what he should do next. When at last, either by the suggestion of some other person or his own sagacious invention, he resolved upon the following stratagem. He posted one part of his army near the place where the river enters Babylon, and the rest in another station below, where the same river leaves the city, was ordered to enter as soon as they should see the channel passable. Having given this direction and encouraged his horses, he went with the useless part of his men to the lake, and did as the queen of Babylon had done. By the opening a large trench, he turned the stream into the lake, and by that means the river, subsiding, the ancient channel became fordable, which the Persians, who were appointed for that purpose, observing, put their orders in execution, and boldly entering the city, having the water no higher than the middle of the thigh, yet if the Babylonians had been well informed, or had foreseen the attempt of Cyrus, they would doubtless have destroyed his army, and not have been supinely suffered the Persians to pass. For by shutting all the little gates that lead down to the river, and mounting the brickworks along the quay, they might have taken them in a kind of cage, whereby, having no suspicion of such a design, they were unexpectedly surprised by the Persians. The extent of the city was such that we may believe the Babylonians, when those who inhabited near the center were taken, the people that dwelt about the extremities of Babylon heard nothing of their disaster, but were celebrating a festival. Now this is Belshazzar's feast, celebrating a festival that day with dancing and all manner of rejoicing till it received certain information of the general fate, unless Babylon was the first time taken. Well, that's enough from the old history of Herodotus, which you can see it agrees pretty well with the Bible. Now we want to go on with our story. We find here that chapter 6, that the story is leaving Babylon now. It's off the picture. And we're in Medo-Persia. If you make that little distinction there, well, you won't get lost in the story. Alright, chapter 6, verse 1. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom. And over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first, that the princes might give accounts unto them, and the king should have no damage. Now, folks, here in Daniel 6:2 is the first reference that I have at There was a first president, and Daniel was the first president. Not George Washington. Oh, I see. It's a different country, isn't it? Okay. Well, Daniel was preferred by the presidents and princes because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm, the whole nation. Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the king, but they could find none. They couldn't find any occasion or fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was any error or fault found in him. Then said these men, "We shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God." Get it on religious bounds. Well, you can get more fury stirred up and more of a stir by religion than it can politics, I guess. Well, then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king and said thus unto him, "King Darius, live forever." All the presidents of the kingdom, the governors and the princes, the counselors and the captains, have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save of thee, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish a decree and sign the writing, that it may not be changed, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which alters not. Wherefore King Darius signed the writing and the decree. Poor fellow, he didn't know that he was sealing the doom of Daniel, maybe. Now you see to what lengths people will go if they have enmity in their hearts. And here was Daniel without any fault, and they couldn't find any fault. And finally they trumped up this thing to catch him in a trap and get him killed. Well, now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being opened in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed, and gave thanks before his God, as he did aforetime. He wasn't changing his ways. He wasn't scared. He didn't shut the doors and the windows. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. Then they came near and spake before the king concerning the king's decree. Hast thou not signed a decree that every man that shall ask a petition of any god or man within 30 days, save of thee, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? And the king answered and said, "The thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not." Then answered they and said before the king, "Well, that Daniel, which was of the children of the captivity of Judas, regardeth not thee, O king, nor the decree which thou hast signed, but maketh his petition 3 times a day. Then the king, when he heard these words, was sore displeased with himself, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him." But the king was caught in a trap too, wasn't he? Yes, too bad. Then these men assembled unto the king and said unto the king, "Know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is that no decree nor statute which the king establisheth may be changed." That the king commanded, then the king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. Now the king spake and said unto Daniel, "Thy God, whom thou servest continually, he would deliver thee." And a stone was brought, laid upon the mouth of the den, and the king sealed with his own signet, and with the signet of his lords, that the purpose not by turns changed concerning Daniel. So Daniel sown into the lion's den. Well, we have many pictures and paintings of that down over the ages, and all of them I've ever seen are wrong. I wonder if you ever noticed it. Now, as we read on here, we're going to find out that this, what is given in the Bible, is a reverse of what you see in the pictures. So let's see. "Then the king went to his palace and passed a night past him. There were instruments of music brought before him, and his sleep went from him. Then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste unto the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel. And the king spake and said to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God, whom thou servest continually, able to deliver thee from the lions? Then said Daniel unto the king, O king, live forever. My God has sent his angel, and has shut the lions' mouths. And most of the artists had the lions standing there with their mouths open. But God shut the, by his angels, shut the lions' mouths, that they have not hurt me, forasmuch as before him innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt. And I kind of think that if we would think about it, that Daniel probably had his mouth open singing praises to his God. Then the king, exceeding glad for him, and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no manner of hurt was found upon him, because he believed in his God. Now, what's going to happen? We ought to leave you in suspense, sure, hadn't we? And the king commanded, and they brought those men which had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, their children and their wives. And the lions had the mastery of them, and break all their bones in pieces, or ever they came to the bottom of the den. They'd catch them in the air and tear them to pieces. Never touched Daniel. Now, is that a miracle or isn't it? Was Daniel a lion tamer? Or is this really a miracle? Well, Darius was pretty well convinced of what it was anyhow. Then King Darius wrote unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell on all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is a living God, and steadfast forever, and his kingdom which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. He's a little more confident than what Nebuchadnezzar was. I wonder why. Well, now, when you go to finding out who this Darius was, and the names that are used and so on, we've just about got to come to the conclusion that this Darius was the Cyrus that took Babylon that night and killed Belshazzar. And if so, he was the son of Ahasuerus and Esther. Now, can you imagine that that might tone things down a little bit? Remember, Esther was a Jewess. And so he had had enough contact with his mother that he believed in the God of the Jews. He delivereth and rescueth, and he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, who hath delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius, and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Now we're coming to chapter 7. And in this chapter 7, you have practically a review of what we had in chapter 2, but from a different standpoint entirely. And not all the details, maybe. In fact, we have the same thing going over again in chapter 8. I wish that we had our little setup made that we've talked about for years and never got done, but we wanted to make a series of slides on these scenes in Daniel and then make a tape to go along with that to explain the succession of the kingdoms and so on, especially using the image in Daniel 2 and then also in 7 and 8. Never got it done. There's a lot of things we planned on doing. We never got to. Or as I used to say, we didn't get around to it.
All right. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream. Now we're going back before this chapter 6. Going back a little bit in the history, so this isn't in exactly the correct order. But Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream, for he didn't forget it like Nebuchadnezzar did, and told of some other matters. Daniel spake and said, I saw my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven strove upon the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. Notice you had four kingdoms in chapter 2. Here's four beasts coming up out of the sea. Now the sea, of course, is considered among the ancients as the origin of a great many things. The god of the sea was Neptune, who was the devil himself. And remember that the Philistines worshipped Dagon, the god of the sea, and for their initiation of their converts, they dunked them in water. And that is where your baptizing people by dunking in water started. The Jews never did that. They always sprinkled their converts. And yet, of course, that's all been lost sight of. And it's always so nice to have these heathen rites and so on. They look so nice. And not only that, but it's fun to watch somebody get dunked and see whether he's going to strangle or not, you know, and so on. There's always a crowd of curious people on hand. I've been brought up with that sort of thing. I've seen plenty of it. And then one time, a couple of churches were baptizing people in the river, and when the two preachers got through, they baptized each other. They ducked each other in the water, and they had a hilarious time. And that was supposed to be a very solemn and serious time. But even preachers get carried away. Well, at any rate, it was very unsatisfactory, and I was much younger than I am now, and it didn't impress me at all. That's one of the things that helped me get on the right side of things. I just had to tell you a little something that happened there like that. Well, four beasts, and they're all diverse one from another. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. Now, whoever saw a lion with wings like an eagle? I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked. Got his wings pulled off, and was lifted up from the earth, and made to stand upon his feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. That is a strange thing, a lion. He could walk around on his hind feet. Well, we have such pictures of some of the old coats of arms on ancient nations. And behold, another beast, a second like to a bear. It raised up itself on one side. It had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I beheld one other like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. Now think of an animal having four wings. And wings like a fowl, but you don't know of any fowls that have four wings, do you? And that beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. Now, would you like a job of feeding an animal like that with four heads? After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue of the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Some of you folks probably have remember seeing my chart that I have of these four kingdoms and these beasts and so on. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another, a little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were the eyes like the eyes of man, and a mouth speaking great things. These are fantastic dreams, aren't they? But they were given to Daniel, and they had a meaning. And Daniel says, I beheld, or I looked, till the thrones were cast down. Now, watch it. The thrones at that time, when they sat in council, were silk cushions. And they were filled pretty well and fairly high. And they just cast them down and sat on them. And so he says, I looked until the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit. The Ancient of Days, referring to the Lord himself, whose garment was white as snow, and his hair of his head like the pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, his wheels as burning fire. Must have been some wheels on that throne. Well, sometimes there were. So you can sort of picture it. There he is, a white garment, and the hair of his head like pure wool, and that'd be white too. And his throne was like a fiery flame. Can you imagine that? And the wheels of burning fire. And a fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousand thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. Any idea what scene this might be? It could be the great white throne judgment, but I'm rather doubtful. There are some things that don't fit just too well. We have some other judgments mentioned. There's one in Matthew 25, the judgment of the living nations. Whatever it is, it's something that's wonderful. I beheld him because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake. I beheld even till the beast was slain, his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. So whatever this is, he is destroyed, burned up. As concerning the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and time. Now, in our chart and making our comparisons, we had this lion here, right level with and parallel with the head of gold, Nebuchadnezzar's king. And the second beast, let's see here, a bear, and raised up on one side, looking like one side was higher than the other, Medo-Persia. The three ribs there, now, I'm not too sure who those might be, but there were some conquering that they did, and on our chart we put some of them as a suggestion, but not to be absolutely true. Then there was a leopard, four wings of a fowl. Now that's like the goat that was so fast that we have in the next chapter, or that would be the kingdom of brass. And that, of course, was Greece, and Alexander being the head. And so here you have these in parallel with the ones that you have in chapter 2. And so back in verse 13, I saw in the night vision, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven, and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory, and a kingdom that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. Looking forward to the millennial kingdom. Now, when you begin to study Daniel rather intensely, and you study the book of Revelation, you can find there's a lot of things in common. In fact, when the little book is opened in the Revelation, it's evidently the little book of Daniel is to close and seal until the time of the end. That, of course, is in the latter part of the book. So there's quite a connection between the two. And it's an interesting study. For Daniel was grieved in my spirit, in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. He couldn't figure out what this was all about. I came near unto one of them, I stood by, and asked him the truth of all of this. So he told me, and made me know the interpretation of the things. These great beasts, which are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. So at the end of these four great kingdoms, ending up with Rome, then the saints of the Most High, the overcomers in the millennium, will take and possess the kingdom forever and forever. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, whose teeth were of iron, their nails of brass, which devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with his feet. And I'd want to know too, wouldn't you? And of the ten horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom three fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth, that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints, and prevailed against them, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom, going through tribulation and so on until the overcoming. And so it must be that about a time of the tribulation will be the ending of the last empire, a mixture of the Roman Empire, the iron mixed with clay. Well, we have spoken on that to some extent. Verse 20 again. And of the ten horns that were in his head, and the other that came up, and before whom three fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth, that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints, and prevailed over them. And there is to be a time when there will be a great tribulation. Lots of people are dying. Until the Ancient of Days, the Lord himself came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High. And the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. And the ten horns out of this kingdom are ten kings that shall arise, and another rise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue three kings. Now, folks, I want you to be careful about one thing in all of this. I know people want to drag the United States and Great Britain and Russia, and I don't know who all into it. Well, now, this isn't about these nations. It's about nations that's near to Israel, and there'll be ten of them. There'll be another one out, come out of that, and there'll be three that be special. But that's in a future time. We can't, by any means, I don't think we can identify any of them now. But it's quite likely that the enemies of Israel will be a fulfillment of prophecy that was made way back in the time of Isaac, of Jacob and Esau, and that there'd be war between the two. And of course, you know, the descendants of Esau are the Mohammedans, Islam religion, and down through the centuries there has been wars, especially back in the Crusades. So a lot of these things have to some extent be fulfilled. But this one horn has not come forth yet, and three of these have not been subdued yet. That comes in the future. Now, thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth king upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall guard the whole earth, and shred it down, and break it in pieces. And the ten horns of this kingdom are ten kings that shall arise, another rise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first. He shall subdue three kings. He shall speak great words against the Most High, and swear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, that they should be given into his hand until a time and times and a dividing of time. Now, what's a time and times and dividing of time? Well, a time is spoken of quite often as a year. So it'd be 1 year times 2 years, it makes three, and dividing or half a time would be one half. That'd be 3 1/2 years. And there will be a great tribulation of 3 1/2 years, also of 42 months. And so on. Different figures giving you the same answer when you come to the end of it. Now going on. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people as the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations which troubled me, and my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. And no use of going around and telling one like that. It would sound silly, wouldn't it? Well, I think Daniel began to see a little bit of the outcome of things. You know, after all, God was quite kind to Daniel. We put him in a position where he had to suffer and have his troubles and so forth, but he gave him a lot of joy and blessing and so on along the way. So Daniel didn't have such a rough time of it after all, when you really consider it, although I wouldn't want to trade places with him, I don't think. But here is a great prophet, Daniel. As we've said before, his prophecy can connect quite a bit with the revelation, connect quite a bit with the forecastings of Isaiah especially, and other prophets. And we do find that some of the prophecy has been fulfilled, and fulfilled to the letter, which gives us a pretty good idea that the rest of it will be fulfilled likewise. And of course we know that God, who has ordained these things, he will finish it. Nobody can stop him. People might think they could. They would like to do something like that, but people aren't much in the sight of God. Now I'll go on with the next one for a little bit. I have some other introductions here, but I think I can leave that for later. 8th chapter, 1st verse. In the 3rd year of the reign of King Belshazzar, this is going back now before the Medo-Persian reign, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision, I was by the river Aulai. Now that's a little way from Babylon. Getting pretty near to Nineveh. Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram with two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. And I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him. Neither was there any man that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. Now, in this chapter, you're going to have these kingdoms again, but not all of them. You only have a couple of them. And they're more explained. Now, if you will look at this, I notice that this is a ram. Two horns, and one higher than the other, and so on. That goes right along with a bear with one shoulder higher than the other. Also goes along with your kingdom of silver back in chapter 2. And as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. Now, you know, that's running some. If he could run so fast he didn't touch the ground, that's about like some drivers we have today on the roads, isn't it? Now, this is a picture of one of the swiftest generals in history. A man who conquered the world and sat down and wept because he didn't have any more to conquer, and there's only 27 men. Alexander the Great. And he just won his wars because he could get his armies there and on the spot and get the spot chosen and everything before the rest of them could get there. And he had a notable horn between his eyes, representing Alexander himself. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him close unto the ram, and he was moved to choler, anger against him, and smote the ram, break his two horns. There was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground, and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Now, I have spent my time here. We're going to have to stop here and do this another time.